buy an expensive car, we give them premium fuel, and then we take it for servicing, and we take care of them. But our bodies, we've just treated them so badly, not realizing it's our doing. What we put in our body is what's controlling our mind, and what we consume through our mind is what's controlling our body.
This is Evolve CPG's Brands for a Better World podcast, featuring purpose-driven leaders who not only believe in better, but actively pursue it. That better products, better brands, and better leadership for a better world. Thanks to you, our listeners, this podcast is now ranked in the top 10% of all podcasts globally. Let's not stop there, though. You can help us reach more people by taking a moment to leave us a rating or review, which is critical for podcast algorithms, and by sharing your favorite episodes with your network. The more people we reach, the more good we can bring about in this world. If you work in the industry, you can also join our online community where we're going further, faster, together at community.evolvecpg.com. I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder and creative director of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow and scale their impact. On this episode, we're speaking with Richa Gupta, founder of Good Food for Good, about why she transitioned from fashion to food, what inspired her to build a buy one, feed one business model, who inspired her to set big goals, why you'll find pumpkin seeds in her bolognese sauce, and more.
Hi, Gage. I'm Richa. I'm founder of Good Food for Good. We are a Canadian social enterprise on a mission to make it easy for people to eat well and do good.
Love it. And I'm excited to dig more into what you mean by eat well and do good. But first, I'd love to hear how you ended up where you are now. So I was poking around in your background. It looked like you started out working in clothing at a couple different places, but one notably Hudson's Bay. But then not too long after that, you eventually found yourself working in food at General Mills. So how did that transition happen? Like, why did you start in clothing, and how did you end up deciding to switch over to food?
It's a very, very interesting question. Not many people know that, and not many people ask that, but that's where my journey started. I still clearly remember, even in my teens, all I wanted to do was fashion. That was my creative outlet. However, you know, after years of working in fashion, I worked in India, I worked in US, and then I moved to Canada and I was working at Hudson's Bay. I think I was about 30 at that time and pregnant with my daughter. I just started feeling or seeing the fashion industry as very superficial. I think time of life, you know, stage of my life. I started questioning, is this my life going to be, fighting over buttons and threads? And, you know, the color of thread does not match the button or the shirt, or, and just wanted to do something more meaningful. So I decided, as I was an immigrant to Canada, and it's actually very difficult when you are an immigrant to switch industries. So I decided to do my MBA. I went to business school, did my MBA. Actually, while I was partly pregnant, partly during my maternity leave, I finished my MBA from Schulich and joined General Mills in marketing. And the way I explain myself, that I'm not fighting for button and thread, I'm fighting for food, and everyone needs food. So that was my progression from fashion to food.
So was it in the MBA program, or maybe even before going into the MBA program, that you decided food was a better place for you to put your superpowers towards?
In the MBA program, I was actually thinking, I went into MBA thinking I'll join a nonprofit.
Oh.
And then I started learning a lot more about nonprofits, and that model was somehow not fitting to me, that every time you want to do good and you have to just go keep asking money. Like, I felt somewhere in my heart, it didn't feel sustainable, just the way the nonprofits were being run. And while I was there, of course, like, MBA schools are all about either finance, consulting, or marketing, right? So marketing was the other option that felt, you know, something that I could relate to. It was about human psychology, like something about marketing that spoke to me more so than the finance and the consulting side of business. So I did interview for internship at General Mills, went there, loved the people I was working with, and convinced myself that food is my path instead of nonprofit is my path.
Nice. Yeah, I totally resonate with that. I've have done a lot of nonprofit leadership and continue to do it. But my feeling is that to make a big enough impact, I like the for-profit but for-purpose business model because it funds itself is one thing I like. Whereas all the nonprofit work I do, you're constantly wondering where you're going to get money to do the work. Granted, there are hybrid models where nonprofits have services that pay for things so they don't have to beg money all the time, beg for money all the time. But what I love about for-profit, for-good businesses, especially if it's a product, is like the product can have a purpose, your business can have a purpose, and you can put your money towards that purpose and other good purposes too. So it's just kind of self-fulfilling and self-fueling kind of process of impact, which I love.
Exactly. You nailed it.
And I know your passion for food kind of started earlier on in your life. You said you grew up in a household where you always got delicious home-cooked and I think healthy meals. So was that part of the appeal as well? Is it just felt like not only a way to make an impact and purpose, but it just felt like home to some degree?
Yeah, I would say that. And I think, to be honest, I think every human being is in food industry in a way. Right? Like whether we consume, what we like, what we don't like, dictates what happens in the industry. Food is so much part of our everyday. And I was so lucky. I grew up in a household where my mother loved to cook. I grew up in India. So my mother really enjoyed cooking. And even though at that time, I didn't see cooking as a creative outlet, I saw it more as, you know, I was the rebellious child. I'm a girl and I shouldn't be asked to cook. Why am I cooking? That's who I was, right?
Yeah.
Though my mom was pretty strict, she made sure that I learned how to cook. And I enjoyed doing that even during my high school years and university years. Every time, so once a week, I was supposed to cook. We had three siblings. Everybody cooked once a week. So once a week, I was supposed to cook and I would either make my favorite dish or I would, and that time there was no internet, by the way. Or I would go to the library or a magazine and get a new recipe and I'll create that recipe. So I had, like, I did see it as, you know, if I'm doing it, I want to do it creatively. That's how I see life. I think it's our opportunity to make something and that gives me the most pleasure. So the love started there. And when I got married and moved to North America, I actually learned most of my cooking or creative cooking watching Food Network. Because, and that also says something about it. I could have watched so many things, but I spent hours watching Food Network. And then my poor husband was the guinea pig of all the creations that I made.
That's funny.
That I used to make. And yes, I think all of that combined and then what I went through at General Mills or what I felt, it's just, it feels like every little thing that happened in my life somehow was meant to create good food for good where I'm today.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that, that sometimes we don't know where our path is going, but somehow whatever we've done in our past leads to wherever we end up, right? Like it's just, whether or not you plan it, it all ends up being perfect somehow. It's like, great, I am in this situation where I need these skill sets and I happen to work in this job in college or in high school or in whatever, and now I have those skills or whatever, but you kind of get what you need along the way. I love that.
Exactly, exactly. That's the beauty of universe.
Yeah. So working at General Mills, you got a taste for the food industry. You decided you liked it. And at some point, you decided you needed to launch your own brand, which some people, you know, would just stay working at General Mills, the nice, safe way of working in food and not having to take the risk and stress yourself out. But you decided to take the leap. So what was it that inspired you to become an entrepreneur? And why focus on nutritious sauces?
Very deep question. It'll be a long answer, just warning. Perfect. Already. So at General Mills, as I said, like I really liked my colleagues. I loved the people. My internship was great. They offered me the job after internship. I joined back right after finishing my MBA. My first year and a half, I absolutely loved it. They give you so much freedom. They make you, you're pretty much running the business, right? So you feel like you're a CEO. Lots of power. Lots of understanding of consumer behavior. However, at some point, my role changed a little, and I was focusing on holistic margin management, where my role was a lot about looking into ingredients or looking at the process and figuring out how can we cut down the costs. during that time, also my daughter was getting old enough where she was eating real food. And I had to cook that real food after reaching back home at whatever wee hours. And I started questioning, right? Like what was going in these shortcuts that I would buy for my daughter, or even the products that General Mills was making. I would ask questions on why do we have these ingredients? And then I'll do research. What does that ingredient do? So I guess as an industry insider, I uncovered things that didn't make me feel that good about doing what I was doing, especially because like I left an industry thinking I wanted to do something meaningful. I spent multiple years doing my master's, working for, first preparing for my MBA, doing my MBA, going there. And now I felt like I was back in the situation where I was not on the good side of things. There was some this innate need of I want to do something meaningful, something that does good. And when I started discovering what was going in our food, and at that time, or maybe because I was at that stage of my personal life, all that information was everywhere in front of me. So it was becoming, I'm sure people were talking about it even in 1990s and 1970s and 1980s. I just started hearing it a lot more in like 2010 onwards because I had my child in 2009, right? So it's a stage of life when you start thinking about all those things. And that just left me lost. I was lost in my personal life trying to make food for my child that met my standards of food, seeing, you know, having a mother who cooked three meals a day from fresh fruits. And here I am. I'm making one meal for my child, and that too, I'm trying to scramble things from the stores that have ingredients that I didn't call food. And as a parent, you always want to do better for your kids than what your parents. It's just that's how we humans are designed to work, right? We want to do the best that we can for our child. And I felt lost there. I felt lost in my job. So when this idea came to me about making something, maybe perhaps I can make something that fills this gap, that makes a difference in lives of people like me, like mothers struggling to make delicious food for their kids that is, you know, nutritious, yet I think nutrition and delicious need to go hand in hand. It's food, end of the day. We enjoy it, we relish it, and also make a positive difference, right? So my soul at the end of the day feels good about doing what I'm doing. And during my MBA, I came across Tom's shoes. And I absolutely fell in love with the model. I read his book, Start Something That Matters. So that always was at the back of my mind that if I would ever do something, it would have that model. So it was like, seriously, you were talking about, you know, most people would stay in the job being in food industry. For me, because I was in such a dark space and this idea felt like falling in love, I felt so good. It just felt like this is the bright, shiny light. And I am, you know, in a dark dungeon right now that it'll take me through, right? So I don't think if I was not in the headspace that I was, I wouldn't have started this business.
Right.
Right? It was
again, you always get what you need, like we were saying before, right? If you hadn't had the experiences you had, good or bad, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, it felt like falling in love, and love is blind, and I jumped with both feet, and here I am.
Love it. And speaking of maybe you wouldn't be doing what you're doing now, I wonder if you weren't working in food at General Mills, would you have been looking at the nutrition labels and the ingredient panels and starting to question the food you were eating, or would you have just been a busy, possibly overworked parent trying to provide for their kid and just like maybe just take advice from social media influencers or, you know, recipes on Pinterest or, like you said, the cooking shows you were watching and just call it a day? Like that might have been your source of information. And on a lot of those stores or websites or channels, they're not really talking about the ingredients. They're not really talking about the nutrition. They're just talking about quick, easy, tasty. Maybe at the most, you might get more plant-based or something like that to provide for your family, like anything trend-based, but they're probably not digging deep into nutrition and ingredients and sourcing or anything like that.
Yeah, I owe it to General Mills. I seriously, today, wherever I am today, I owe it to everything that happened in my life. Because it's quite possible. I worked in fashion, right? I worked in a super, super superficial industry where it was, I would have just eaten bougie food. I wouldn't have cared what was going into that food and probably fed my child the same thing. And maybe I would have bought organic, or again, the buzzwords, all natural, or, you know, take this and get help with this.
Yeah.
Perhaps I would have been that mother. But yeah, it's, you know, as we say, every step you take is taking you somewhere. You just don't know right now where.
Yeah, I love that. And it's also, when I'm thinking about it too, your daughter, if you didn't have a daughter, you might not have been thinking about, crap, I need to cook something quick and nutritious, and reminding yourself of your upbringing with home-cooked meals, and then starting to want to take care of, or be more concerned about what you're putting in your daughter's body to give her a bright future, right? And I think a lot of founders, or a lot of founder-led businesses, start from kids, from having kids, from wanting to take care of those kids, whether it's food or clothing or environmental stuff or whatever else it is. I think there's something about having the kids that makes you start thinking more long-term about the future, about their future, but also about future in general for other generations, right? Whereas when you're an adult without kids, it's so easy to just get caught up in the day-to-day, or the keeping up with the Joneses, or seeing what fancy car your neighbor has and wanting to get a fancy car like that. But but when you have kids, you start questioning some of these things of, wait a minute, what are we doing? What kind of world are we building for those kids?
I couldn't agree more. I think I was always quite self-absorbed person. So it was, you know, all about me and, you know, my needs, and not about the world. Like I was not a worldly kid who would know about what's happening in the world or what's climate change or anything. I was, you know, building my life. It was my early career in India. Then I moved to US, and from US to Canada, a lot of my time and energy was going in building my life in this new country. So definitely I wasn't paying attention to what was going on till I became pregnant, till I knew there was something in here that the only thing I can control is what I do to myself, or what I put in my body. Yeah. Is the only control I have on what this child, or this whatever I'm baking inside, is going to be. That's when when I was pregnant, we switched to 100% organic. I was in the best shape of my life when I was pregnant with my daughter, because I was nice. Working out like 3 times a week. I was doing meditation. I was doing yoga. It's just like, I read enough to know that my state of mind and my health is all that I can control to give this baby a healthy life. And that's what I did for 9 months.
That's amazing. I do hear a lot of people talking about worrying about what they're eating while they're pregnant, but I think you might be one of the first people I've heard talking about their mindset too, like having a healthy mindset and outlook on life as affecting the child too. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So again, it's all research, right? Like any new change in life. Now I've learned that's my pattern. Anything new, yeah. newness excites me, and then I go deep researching about it. So nice. Change is very important for me, I think, my life, to grow. And maybe that's how it is. Everybody grows when a change happens. Otherwise, we just become, you know, complacent.
Yeah, we grow when we're forced to, in most cases.
Exactly. So when I found out I was pregnant, I just researched the hell out of it. And I read so much about how we feel impacts hormones in our body, and vice versa, right? And how that impacts new, like, babies, your fetus inside you, right? Wow. That's going inside of you. So I wanted to make sure that I am mentally, physically in the best shape. So, you know, whatever has happened has happened. Whatever I did, whatever I drank before, yeah. However much I partied before, you know, I can't control that, but I can control from this day onwards. And I guaranteed I wasn't perfect. I'm sure there were times where I was stressed. There were times, you know, where I was angry. And I'm sure my baby was impacted by that too. But at least I had the right intentions, and I read enough to work towards it.
Right. And I'm sure, like many things, 90% is still an A, right? Like whether you're on a hardcore diet, you can still cheat a little bit on that diet and you're going to be fine. And it's probably the same with nutrition while you're pregnant. I'm sure it's that the majority is what matters, right? If you're feeding that child a bunch of garbage, that's going to have a bad effect. But if you're feeding it 90% good food and occasional garbage, that's probably fine, right? Our bodies are pretty resilient, luckily.
You know what? I saw the difference. Like she, when she was young, in kindergarten, usually kids are always falling sick. She used to be, till elementary school, she used to be one of the kids who, like, the whole class is falling apart and she would be perfectly fine. And in grade 8, now she has this independence. So after school, she goes and she, you know, she drinks at 7-Elevens, like some Slurpees, Starbucks, like every day there is something she's drinking. She hasn't been this sick ever. Oh, like she's catching every cold, every bug that's around, she's gotten it and she's fallen sick. And I was telling her, I'm like, do you see the difference in your diet today versus when I was controlling what was going in your body? Nothing else has changed.
Yeah.
Nothing else has changed. The only thing that has changed is now you have freedom. So you are exercising your freedom, which is fine. Eventually you will learn. And then, you know, you'll remember that, hey, when I ate well, I wasn't this sick. And now I'm drinking sugar every day and look at me.
Yeah.
So yeah, this year has been tough on her and she hates being sick because, you know, this is not something that she's used to. I don't think you ever get used to being sick, but that's what she says. She's like, oh, I hate runny nose and this cough is not leaving me.
Yeah. Another point I was going to touch on too is that the mindfulness and how you're feeling and how it affects your hormones and other things is also tied to food, right? Because there's a lot of, or I don't know about a lot, but I've seen some research at the very least noting that junk foods are causing depression and other kind of mental health states. So it's all connected. It's all, you know, if you got to eat healthy to feel good and you got to feel good to be healthy and so on and so forth. So it's all about taking care of your mind, your body, your soul, all those things all at once, ideally. And, you know, in moderation, you don't have to go super hardcore, but I've personally found in my life, just get the basics of, you know, a pretty good diet, move your body, you know, drink lots of water, do some sort of mindfulness kind of process, and you're good. Like, you don't have to go overboard. Even if it just takes you an hour a day total or something like that to do all the things, like, you'll feel much better the rest of the day, the rest of the week, and so on.
I couldn't agree more with everything you said. Like, there's only one body we are born with. There is no replacement body, replacement parts you can get. But this is all that we have. And we, in the last 30, 40 years, we have used this body like a machine. Like, it's become, like, just that's how the world has become, right? We are using it to make more money. And then we have no time to relax, to give this body what it needs to, you know, even if we're in our cars, right? We buy an expensive car, we give them premium fuel, and then we take it for servicing. And we take care of them, but our bodies, we've just treated them so badly, not realizing it's our doing. What we put in our body is what's controlling our mind, and what we consume through our mind is what's controlling our body. Completely on that path. And you're right, it's simple. Drink a lot of water, eat clean food, you know, food the way food was meant to be, eat less, don't eat too much, right? And move your body and nothing else. You really don't need much. And your mental space, your head space would be in a much better space than anything else. And once that's cleared, then everything else becomes focused. I was in this 10-day meditation retreat. It's a silent meditation retreat not too long ago, actually, end of March. And the food, they only feed you twice a day, pretty much 6:30 in the morning. And then they control all the food you eat, your silence. They're controlling what you're consuming mentally and physically. And then you meditate for like 6 to 8 hours a day. And where you are trying to tell your brain that it's just a thought, you know, it's just a thought, just, you know, let it go. And I thought I would miss talking. I thought I would miss, because you're so used to when you are in this world, right? Everything. I missed nothing. It was so, like, there was a relief, a different kind of, but it's just so hard to explain. I didn't feel agitated.
Like a silence.
Yeah.
A silencing of the mind and all the other things trying to bombard you every day, like your to-do list or advertisements or your schedule or other people asking you to do stuff or whatever, with that silence and focus on simple focus on just your mind and your body, I think there's a peace to that.
So peaceful. It's like, hey, I could live like a monk. That's like life of a monk.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you were also talking about you decided to switch to organic while you were pregnant. Your company focuses on organic, no sugar added, and vegan. So I now know where the organic desire came from, because that's your own personal value that you found. What about the no sugar and vegan? Where did those attributes come in? Why are those so important for your company?
So no sugar also started, as you know, with Rhea, with my daughter. It's so funny. She calls herself, she's the inspiration behind my business. I guess she is. Again, I read about, and we actually didn't give Rhea any sugar till she started going to kindergarten. So all she had was fruits as sugar. And the first time somebody in kindergarten gave her a lollipop, she brought it home and then she ate it. And she asked me to clean her tongue because that's the because that's the first time she felt. Now she's a whole different person. But she's a sugar monster at this point. But, you know, I can't control at this age. You have to let them do what they're doing. And eventually they come back. But that did. I saw a difference. Like, I don't have any recollection of her throwing a temper tantrum ever. As I said, like sickness, like she was healthy. Like everyone around her falling sick, and she, this kid, was healthy and hardy. So I totally believed in. My mom used to make fun of me because as a kid, I ate a lot of sugar. The only thing sometimes I would eat was sugar and bread. Sugar, butter, and bread. That's what I would eat. So,
which is delicious. So, but
exactly, right? But then I wasn't a healthy kid. I did fall sick a lot. I remember in India when I was growing up, every day I would get a headache. My skin was in a bad state. Lots of things, but you don't realize that it's your food that's doing it to you, even though it was all clean food, but it's still the amount of sugar I was eating and not in eating enough vegetables that was really impacting.
Probably contributes to it.
Exactly. So I was that, and I was always a vegetarian. So the vegan part came from just that, you know, it's just one extra step. All you have to do is remove dairy.
Yeah. So did you decide to go that one extra step because you felt like you wanted that in the foods, or because you felt like your target customer, consumer, or whatever would want you to take that extra step?
I think both, because I am also that target customer in a way. And I read a lot about dairy and its impact on the environment. And while I was creating something called Good Food for Good, I didn't want to add things that are bad, right? And I guess that's where it all stems. Like every ingredient that I use, I research enough to make sure that it has the least, like anything we consume has impact on the planet. But the goal is that it has least amount of impact wherever I can control, right? Like, so that's why we went with, and we use seeds. We don't even use nuts because seeds use really less amount of water to grow. And they are actually better for the soil versus nuts and any other legume. Legumes are actually really good. Actually, I should not complain about legumes, but nuts.
Yeah, I was wondering if you did the no nuts for allergies or for sustainability. So that makes sense. They do take a lot of water.
Yeah, kind of both. Initially, I did have cashews in one of my products. And I remember when I started the company, I used to do farmer's market. And this mother and her son came to me once and he's like, oh my God, I love your butter chicken sauce so much, but I wish I could take it to school. And then I started working on that. And then I started reading more about the impact of seeds and nuts and what's better. And I experimented with hemp seeds and started using hemp seeds. And then when the new product we launched, our bolognese, we got into pumpkin seeds because they are another nutrient powerhouse that we have left for birds. All the seeds we have left for birds. Right?
And, one of the smartest animals, so we should probably take a cue from that, right?
Exactly. They're choosing seeds.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I did see that your bolognese sauce had pumpkin seeds in it, which also you won a Nexty Award for Expo West. So congrats on that. That's exciting. But when I saw that your bolognese had pumpkin seeds, that got me curious because I had never tried a bolognese with pumpkin seeds in it before. So I was wondering, was that more for flavor, for nutrition, for texture? Like, and how did you come up with that idea anyway?
That's an interesting story. So our brand, as you know, is Whole30 approved as well. Now Whole30 has a plant-based mandate, but before, when I was researching this product, or when I came up with the idea, they didn't allow any legumes. So I was doing that diet because I want to understand how the consumer feels when they do that diet. It's part of my research process. And being a vegetarian, I felt there weren't many sources of protein that I could consume. So I relied on seeds. And I started making food for myself. And anywhere where I would use nuts or legumes, I would just use seeds. And it tasted so good. So I started researching more about that. And I was like, oh, perhaps we could do a bolognese with the, and there wasn't, even right now, there is no product like ours in the market. Like, most people use Beyond Meat, you know, plant-based meat substitute. And, you know, that does not, highly processed substitutes do not fall in our values or what Good Food for Good stands for. So pumpkin seeds made like a perfect replacement. They give the texture, same amount of protein as your meat sauce. People who are allergic to legumes or legumes give them problems can still consume seeds, nut-free. So there were just overall so many benefits of using pumpkin seeds, and that, you know, we stuck with it.
Yeah, I think I saw that they're a good source of omega-3s or something as well, which I know you also mentioned some of your products have hemp in it, which also have those omega-3s. So there's that nutritional benefit too.
Totally. Magnesium too. And all of us, most people are, you know, depleted in magnesium. That's why seeds are very important, a really good source of magnesium. And we've left it for birds. So I think we all need to just start consuming more seeds in meals, and not just, like, I know people consume seeds in bars and stuff, but bars are also loaded with so many other ingredients. I'm not a bar consumer. So, and I worked with Nature Valley, like I worked at General Mills. That's where they do use seeds, but they are so loaded with sugar. There's so much sugar in those bars that I don't know how can they be even classified as a health food. Seriously.
Yeah, I think that's part of why I skip a lot of bars and other things, is because they're just basically slightly better candy. It's like, I don't understand why we can't just have real food bars instead. Like, especially when Kind was coming out with a savory line, I think Strong and Kind or something like that, for a little bit. Unfortunately, I don't think it took off, but I think that might have been from a recall, from a label misprint or something that just cost too much money and they didn't continue. But it could have been it wasn't selling. But I was excited about that, to just have something that just wasn't pure sugar and could have some savory flavors too, because I don't always want something sweet. But that's, if you want a quick, quote unquote, nutritious snack, it's all sugary stuff. So it's probably just the fault of the American consumer being so obsessed with sweet and sugar. I think most people don't even taste the sugar anymore whenever, because I don't eat a lot of sweet stuff. Whenever I go eat what you would call like a conventional sugary product, I like spit it out. It's so, so overly sweet. I just can't even eat it, or I'll eat like one little bite and be like, okay, I'm done. It's like too much for me. Whereas I see other people just eat two or three of them or four of them or five of them or whatever. And it's just mind blowing. And I think people just get numb to the level of sugar or the level of salt or the level of whatever that's in most of their processed food.
That's exactly what it is, right? Our body, our taste buds get used to what we consume. Once you stop consuming, like, what you feel, I felt the same when I left sugar. I used to have my coffee with sugar. And when I was pregnant with Rhea and tried to get rid of coffee, and it gave me migraine. Later I realized, but then I was off sugar and off coffee. Later I realized when I got back into coffee and left coffee, it didn't give me migraines. That was sugar withdrawal and not caffeine withdrawal that was giving me headaches. And that's what happens. Our body, and sugar is one thing, you start eating, you just want to keep eating. That's the dopamine that it produces in our brain is very addictive.
Yeah, I feel thankful that I somehow didn't get that much of that gene or whatever with sugar, because even when I was a kid, I quit drinking soda at a very young age because I found it kind of disgusting, to be honest. It's just
good.
So,
yeah, no,
so sweet and so sugary. And I was obsessed with other things like V8 instead. Like I just always liked vegetables and savory kind of stuff. I just wasn't super drawn to sugar. I only became a somewhat sugar eater when I got with my ex-wife, who is obsessed with sugar. And so she got me like eating more sugar then. And now my current girlfriend, she's also loves sugar. So we'll have like treats from a bake shop or a bakery or something like that every once in a while. And I'll eat those, but I'll eat like a couple bites and then put it down, and she'll eat like three whole treats and then like start eyeing mine. And I tell her, nope, I'm going to eat the rest in a couple days or tomorrow or something like that. But it's always been one of those things that I just naturally eat less of. So I'm thankful for that because I can see how addicting it is for most other people. But that's really interesting that you said your quote unquote caffeine addiction was actually more of a sugar addiction or withdrawal. So I'm going to have to ask, because I have friends who quit caffeine for those reasons. They feel like they're addicted because when they don't drink it, they get headaches. But I'm going to have to ask them now if they put sugar in their coffee, because that might be the cause instead.
Yeah, totally. And coffee too. Like I drink coffee, but very rarely. But I did see the difference when I left coffee for a long period of time and then I got back into coffee. I got jitters. And normally when you drink it, you wouldn't, right? Like my stomach would hurt and I would get jitters, and then your body gets used to it and then you continue consuming. But if you leave it for a long time and then you accidentally, like, and I forgot to tell the person that made me a decaf. So I got, by mistake, a caffeinated, and I was eating dinner and my hand was shaking. My burrito, like my hand was literally like, what's wrong with me?
And they accidentally put 4 shots of espresso in there for you.
I guess. It wasn't a good feeling. Let's put it that way.
So you also mentioned a little bit early on that you got inspired by the Tom Shoes case study, which is famous for being one of the first kind of buy one, give one type models. And I know that you have a buy one, feed one model. And it's all kind of tied to what you describe as like wanting to bridge the gap between giving and consumption. So was that all inspired by Tom Shoes, or was there some other innate desire in you to kind of solve this unchecked consumption that we have in our culture?
I think it, you know, all boils down to the time that I was working at Hudson's Bay, right? Like, again, if I look back at the, there was definitely something. And when I look back, there was an incident even when I was in India that happened that left me questioning my choices. But anyways, I ignored it and I continued to work in the industry for a decade after, which opened my eyes to the dark side of consumption, of what people go through. I met some artisans and they were in really bad state and they were making these prettiest outfits, like wedding collections in India are a big thing. People spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to buy them, but people who actually make them live in really, really poor conditions. And the first time I witnessed that, I didn't want to work in that industry anymore. And that was very early on. But that was the career that I chose. So I closed my eyes. I switched my lane a bit. Instead of design, I went into the business development. So I never had to see that again. I don't know if it was that part that stayed in my head, or, you know, the part when I became a mother, that it came back, that saying that, okay, now you need to do something about it. There was some calling kept knocking at my door to figure out a way to do something more meaningful than doing something just for myself, which is what, you know, and there's nothing wrong in it to take care of yourself and take care of your family is great. I couldn't find satisfaction in just doing that. And that just drove me, that was just the path. And you get attracted, once you have that feeling, those are the things that you get attracted towards too, right? So when Tom's Shoes, it didn't impact, not everybody in my class was so moved by Tom's model the way I was moved. So there is, I think we always have something in it. It's just that, you know, the little light, and then you see something and it sparks your interest more, and then it gets bigger, and then you attract that tribe, you know. So I was flowing like a river, and it took me, my river life showed me these different things, and I just kept taking what I felt I needed to take to feel good about.
That's interesting that you kind of point that out, because I was going to ask, do you feel like it was your exposure to seeing poor working conditions in India and this Tom shoes and other things that you were just exposed to that triggered it. But to your point, plenty of other people are exposed to those kind of things and they don't change their life. They don't change their purchase habits. They don't go start a company. So what is it that makes somebody impact driven? Like, is it their upbringing? Is it just in their personality? I'm not entirely sure, but I guess I typically thought it was a series of circumstances, like maybe the way they were raised, the conditions they lived in, or the conditions they saw other people lived in, and they felt compelled to act on it. But a lot of people don't feel compelled to act. So there is something different about impact-driven people where there's just something in you, like you said, that's this calling that keeps knocking on the door, and you just add up all the signs that you're seeing eventually and decide where you're going to make your impact. But there's that impact spark inside of you from the beginning. And sometimes it just takes a few life moments to pull it out. Like you said, you know, in your early party days or in my early party days or early parts of my career, you know, I was doing what I thought I was supposed to be doing, but there was always something in the back of my mind saying, this isn't right. This doesn't feel like me. This doesn't feel like my path. And it wasn't until I took a step back from the path that I thought I was supposed to be on to take a look at other alternatives that I found the path that I'm on now that feels like me, that feels like I'm, you know, going towards that calling. So I don't know if other people just always have that in the back of their mind too, and they just don't act on it because they're so caught up in the noise of culture and day-to-day needs and obligations and shoulds and should nots and so on and so forth, or if there's just some people who have that calling and some people who don't.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer. Perhaps we can put a research study out and speak to people. But it's, you know, humans overall, I think our lives are so complicated. There are influences from all over, right? Like, yes, our parents are our influencer, but so and our influences, but so does society, so does our peers, so does our parents of our peers, so does our coworkers, so does whatever information we let our brain absorb. And how we make those connections, how we define who we are, right? Or what image makes us happy about ourselves. End of the day, that's what it is, right? And then we try and fulfill that image for ourselves by doing things that fit with that image. For some people, it is success. Like, success means just making more money, having a bigger house, and that's what their goal is, right? Bigger and then a bigger house and then even a bigger house. And that's the image that they have created, right? For you and I, perhaps we created somewhere in our heart an image for ourselves, which is, you know, we want to be, or we something about people doing good we found inspirational. And then, or aspiring, we aspire to do that, and we created that image for ourselves. And then we just started taking steps towards it, knowingly or unknowingly. And this whole concept became a little clearer to me in the retreat that I did, meditation retreat, where he talks about, like, there was a discourse where he was talking about, who are you? You're just an image that you've created for yourself. And like he explained it in such a beautiful way that it made so much sense. On, like, we don't know as when you're a kid, you just like this or you don't like that, but you don't have that whole thing built up. But as we grow up, every little thing we fit in that, we do things that fit in that image, and we don't do things that don't fit in that image that we have made for ourselves. Nobody else has made, we have made it. And that's what we portray.
And maybe that's to some degree where suffering or depression or other things can come in, is when you're not doing things that align with your image, but just doing things because you think that's what other people want of you, or because you think that's what will make you fit in or something. And maybe that's to some degree the path to happiness is trying to learn to recognize when you're doing something for yourself or for someone else. I'm not sure. Just spitballing there.
There's just such a long way of actually, how do I fix it? But this is the reality now. At least I've understood that I am doing this for my image satisfaction. I mean, it is technically selfish, because I am doing this because it gives me satisfaction. Everything we do, right? Whoever does whatever they do for it, this is what gives me satisfaction. Something else gives someone else satisfaction. And that's what it is, right?
Totally. Yeah. Now I'm super curious about this. And my ex-wife, she was also the kind of co-founder/partner in my design agency, Modern Species. But she left the business to go study psychology because she's just been always fascinated about how people tick. But she went into IO psychology, which is industrial organizational psychology. So it's about psychology work. But that might be actually a good field. Like maybe she has some research already that she could tell me some answers, or maybe it's something that needs to be studied and she could propose it or something. But I like this idea of like, where does that drive for impact originate?
Yeah,
and I think some of it's like there's that spark there, but you can have a spark that never gets fueled to become a flame. But things that we do along the way that start to feel good, and then we start to identify more as that, and then it starts building up that personality, and eventually it becomes self-fulfilling. Like we think we're this type of person, so we do these kind of things, but by doing those kind of things, now we are that kind of person, and then we don't want to break that contract with ourselves or with others, and we don't want to shift from that path because then, you know, we'll have not been the person we said we were or we've identified as. So it eventually becomes a cycle, I'm sure. But like, where does that original spark come from? That's what I'm curious about right now.
I know. It's very interesting. But again, as I said, human species, we are so complicated. Our brains are so complicated. I wish for everything we do and every act we do and every like and dislike we had, you know, we could pinpoint, right? That would be marvelous.
Absolutely.
Like all childhood traumas explained, our behavior explained.
It's all solved right there.
Everything solved, right?
Maybe we'll get there someday. I feel like, you know, the psychology field is still relatively new, all things considered, compared to like other industries or fields, like physics, for example. So
I agree.
And I feel like even in physics, we're still finding things out, right? So if you project the psychology field out a couple decades, centuries, millennia, or whatever, eventually, maybe we will have it figured out and we'll know exactly how to train our brains or whatever to be who we are and to live our best life in a
totally
easier way and not get sucked into just dopamine drips that put us in a downward spiral.
I think if someone puts in some money towards researching what we Google, and we can actually draft, that's one place where you can actually, they know so much more about us than what we know about ourselves. But if they can chart the thread on, at that moment, this person searched for this, and then this happened in their life, and then this happened, they might be able to come up with like real concrete of this triggered this.
That's interesting. Yeah, partner with the tech companies to do long-term psychological studies on people just to see.
Listening to you anyways. To you
to see what you're listening, what you're watching, what you're reading, what you're researching, what websites you're spending your time on, what actions you're doing, what words you use. You could pile all that data up to find some through lines, some trends.
They know so much more about us than what we know about ourselves.
Yeah. So I noticed that you're also a B Corp, just like Modern Species, and therefore Evolve CPG as well. And you joined the same year as us, which is awesome. Go team, class of 2018 B Corps, right? I guess. You know, you're already doing so much, you know, better products that are better for people, and this give back mission and so on and so forth. So what made you decide to go that additional extra step to get B Corp certified?
Community. It's just good to be part of a community of leaders that think alike. I think all B Corps are trying to work on this business model that's not just good for you, but it's good for the world, right? And I totally believe in power of all versus, you know, power of one alone. You can only go that far. But together, you can actually move mountains. So that's the only reason we went for B Corp. We wanted to just make sure we are part of a community that also thinks like us.
Love it. That's a big part of why I do it. I've just done my entire career community building stuff for exactly the same reason. It's nice to have a place where you belong, but it's also nice to create spaces for other people to feel like they belong. And it's nice to be able to put all those people together into one room, one online space, one whatever, and see what happens. Like just magic comes out of that. So that's why we often use the phrase further, faster together to describe why we want to build this community like Evolve CPG, which is now transitioning into impact-driven community, because we've invited some other impact-driven folks to like, the more the merrier. Let's all get together and all kind of mix the pot, so to speak, and see what comes out of it. So I love that. And I agree, the B Corp community is a strong one. So that's a big part of why I like being part of it as well. I know we're running shorter on time. I won't geek out too much more on B Corp at the moment, but I do want to know, what's your proudest moment to date in your business journey?
I would say when we hit the 1 million meals mark, when we donated, when I started the business, that was one of the idea or a number that I threw out, that I want to feed 1 million people. So when we did the numbers and it came to 1 million meals, I would say that felt really good. Right? Like I could have still been working at General Mills and still making probably more money than what I'm making right now. But I wouldn't have been able to feel this feeling that something I did helped someone else who I would never even know, or they would never even know me. That felt pretty good.
That's really cool. So it started off as wanting to feed one person, your daughter. I guess yourself exactly. As well, maybe two or three people yeah. or something like that. But then it turned into feeding 1 million meals plus, you know, more to come, which is amazing. Out of curiosity, I'm always wondering, like, when people set these big goals of like, I want to do, you know, help 1,000 companies or feed 1 million people or, you know, teach 1 million, 1 billion classes or I don't know, whatever it is. When you set that number, did it feel feasible at the time, or were you setting that because it seemed like this giant number that would take you 10, 20 years of being in business to fulfill that number?
There's a story behind that too. So when I started the company, I was telling you, I used to do farmer's market and I used to tell people, you know, I was not doing this for money. I fell in love and I really just wanted to do something good. That was the sole reason. And during early days, I was one of our bedrooms in our house. We were doing Airbnb to make some extra cash because I was not really making any money. And this gentleman, I think he was one of our first guests, he came and stayed with us. He's from New Zealand and I live in Canada, very far. He came and he was attending some conference or whatever, but he and I got talking and he started telling me, trying to understand why do I have such a negative connotation with money, like what negative relationship with money, right? Like, it's okay, you make money. When you make more money, you can help more people. Why do you always keep saying that, you know, you're not doing this for money? But money would give you the means to make it happy. So he actually inspired me to put a goal and put a number out in the universe. He's like, doesn't matter how many years, just put a number. And I'm telling you, when you go there, when you reach that, that'll make you so much happier than not having any goal or, you know, trying to see the goal is all about money. That's how I put everything that competition or capitalism was bad, money was bad. Like, that's the mental state that I was in when I started the company. So he, thanks to James, that I did put that number out there. And I don't think I would have done it if I was not, you know, him guiding me.
Yeah, I love that, especially because I feel like I have similar battles of, you know, not doing this for money, and I, you know, give away so much work and time and pay myself less than I pay my employees and do all this kind of stuff, because for me, it's about the impact, not the money, right? But that also leads to unhealthy mindsets where I could be making a lot more impact if I did focus more on money and growth. But for me, like, money and growth have not seemed like the goals themselves. It's the impact you're trying to make with that. So one thing that my team members and consultants are advising me to do in a similar way is like, well, why don't you set some big goals around what that impact looks like? And then maybe that'll inspire me to like go get the money to make that impact, right? So that's
exactly
cool. So to wrap up then, what advice would you give other aspiring entrepreneurs?
I always tell people, go do it. Take the first step. It'll guide you to the next step. This is something you want to do. Entrepreneurship is what excites you. You know, don't reach your deathbed without taking the few steps. And sometimes you get into it and you realize it's not for you. And that's fine. That's a decision you take. Don't see it as failure. Or, you know, when I started the company, I knew like food businesses fail, CPGs fail, all businesses, any business can fail. And I saw it as, this is my learning time, right? Like, no matter what I do, when I get off this entrepreneurship path, or if the company doesn't work, I know I would have gained enough skills to contribute somewhere or the other. I'm not just wasting my time. I would have still learned a lot, created some value that I could take to a different level. So I always tell entrepreneurs to take the first step. Just do it. Nike.
Yeah, totally. I'm listening to the Nike memoir Shoe Dogs right now. So that's exactly where my mind was going to with the just do it. But I also love that attitude of don't overthink it. You know, you don't have to have a whole plan or a full certainty around what you're doing. You just have to know what the next step is and take that. That's it. It's just have an idea of which direction you're heading. Take a step in that direction and see if that's the right direction. If not, turn around and go the other direction. You know, it's just step by step is all it takes. And then to your point, if you get to a fork in the road and that's not the path you want to be on, but there's this other path, well, great. Everything you just did before this led you to that fork, and all the skills and knowledge and connections and everything you made on this previous path will help you on this next path that you're going to go on. So I like that kind of mindset of just dig in and start learning and see where you want to go, and then feel free to pivot along the way, because it might just, this stepping stone just might be the learning you needed for something else in the future. And if you don't take it now, you won't have that skill set or that knowledge or that perspective that'll get you to where you need to be in the future.
Totally. You sum it up so well. Exactly. I think in life too, right? Even in our personal lives, who has seen tomorrow? Like, who knows what changes next second? All we have is this moment, and this is what you feel like doing it.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great place to wrap up. So I just want to say thanks for being who you are and having that impact-driven spark and doing something about it, just getting up and taking those next steps, and for, you know, going the extra mile in so many ways with your business to make better products, run your business in a better way, and give back to the community. And I'm sure many more things to come. And big congrats on that 1 million meals marker. That must feel amazing, and I'll look forward to hearing your next big goal that'll keep you driving from there. So thanks for carving out some time to share your story on the show with our community, and thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. It was all my pleasure, and we've already reached about 2 million meals by now. That was the most exciting part of this journey, but it's always good to talk to like-minded people. So thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Richa and her company, visit goodfoodforgood.ca. Subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel for more innovator interviews, expert advice, and leadership discussions. If you like this episode, leave a heart, thumbs up, or review, and share it with your colleagues. As an ever-evolving show, we also love feedback, so send us ideas for who we should talk to next to evolve@modernspecies.com. And of course, if you work in the industry, come join our community at community.evolvecpg.com, and we'll go further, faster together.